The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, warm greetings for everyone. Happy to have you all here. And before the pandemic, we used to broadcast these Sunday morning talks on YouTube, but I never thought about the people on YouTube. But now I do, so now, clearly, they're right there, where the camera is. So, thank you for those of you logging in today. So, the topic that I want to talk about today is time. It's been on my mind lately. And I want to tell you a story from my time at the monastery. Sahara. I was the kitchen manager, I guess. So I was like the person most responsible for the production of the food and the meals. And there was a crew of anywhere from maybe 4 to sometimes 10, depending on the time of the year that I supervised. And but during the retreat time, we had 3 months of retreats. And at that time, in Zen, things are highly choreographed. The schedule is really clear and set. And it's kind of like time is one of the teachers in a Zen monastery, because you have to kind of do things on time. And also you have to stop on time. One of the great challenges was we'd have this 15-minute cleaning period, raking the grounds or sweeping or doing something. And when the bell rang to end it, you couldn't just keep doing it to finish the job. When the time to end happened, you were supposed to stop. And then it took a training. People to learn it's okay to stop. Next day you can do it some more. So anyways, everything's choreographed on time, and so one of the things that was meals. And meals basically had to be served up in the meditation hall at the minute that it was supposed to be there, because there was all this ritual beforehand. And so the ritual, people were chanting and bowing and doing all this stuff, and then sitting in the meditation hall, you know, just for the meal to come. And so in order for it all to go smoothly, you know, the meal had to be there right on time. So I don't remember exactly when lunch was, but maybe the food had to be ready and at the door of the meditation hall at something like 12:15 or 12:20. And then we had us, and it was kind of, you know, hectic to get everything ready. But then one of the rules of one of the practices of the monastery, when you worked in the kitchen, at noon, exactly at 12 o'clock, all the cooks had to stop what they were doing, go in front of the kitchen altar, and chant the Heart Sutra, chant this text. And I would regularly, since I was supervising, you know, kind of like be aghast. No! We're never going to get done. We have all the stuff to do, and just like 15 minutes before it's supposed to be served up. No. But you had to do it. So we would chant the Heart Sutra. And always, when we finished chanting, there was more time to get it done without fail. And the meal was always ready. But somehow the sense of time for me was very much tied up in how busy my mind was. How much my mind was concerned with all the things and the desires and the complications, and my mind was crowded. And somehow that crowded impulse of the mind, the pressure of the mind, I had a very different feeling about time than after chanting. My mind got calm and settled, and there was more space in my mind, more calm in my mind. And they just seemed like, oh yeah, we have time. And somehow, I don't know if we worked naturally faster or just it was all an illusion to my mind, but we always had time. So In the years since then, there have been times when I feel like I'm running out of time, I'm too hectic, too much to do, what am I going to do, and don't know which foot to stand on because there's so much to do. And I learned that if that happens, I just do one more thing. And that seems impossible, right? Which is sit down to meditate. And I'll meditate for 10 minutes. And then when I come up, suddenly, oh, there's time. I'll do this now. And I'm still here. I've survived. And so it always works out. It's remarkable to do this. But I had no one waiting for me, so it wasn't like, you know, I took the 10 minutes when people were already up in the car ready for me to come. You know, that wouldn't make sense. But so time, the sense of time, our relationship time, is a fascinating topic, an important topic, because a lot of suffering that people have is directly or indirectly connected to the topic of time. And if we consider a little bit the nature of time, and how we live in time, and often in subconscious ways, unconscious ways, we'll start seeing our life in a different way. Some people are time poor, impoverished in time, because time is constantly slipping away. They're running out of time. They didn't have enough time, so they ran out of time for whatever they had to do, or their time has deadlines and things, you know, and so they have to finish before a certain time. And people are struggling with these notions about time. And part of it is the nature of, you know, industrial society, when things started getting regimented and organized, that people started to have to show up at these factories at a particular time and had to... We have teams of people had to kind of be organized, shifts and all kinds of things. And then with the industrial form, kind of idea of scheduled time, there arose the idea of school time. And my understanding is that school time was kind of modeled on the kind of what happened in factories. And so then school time became very regimented. I guess a lot of people didn't go to school before that, or education happened in a different way that was not so time-centric, you know. And I remember when in high school the bell rang and leave the classroom, and it was just like this sea of humanity in the hallway, you know, jostling for their way to the next classroom. But if you left the classrooms to go somewhere during class, it was really peaceful in the hallways. But, you know, this rhythm of temporal rhythm that we were living in then, that was... And I don't know, you know, nowadays Zen monasteries in Japan and America, they're very time-centric. I don't know if that was always the case. I don't know when that started. In the ancient times in Zen, they knew when to end the morning meditation, when the person who could see the bell could look at their palm and see the lines in their palm. So that's a kind of a different kind of time than waiting for the clock to, you know, clock hands to be in a certain position. So we've kind of lived in time. And the other day I was reading about, parts of our society now are running on nanoseconds. You know, the partial nanoseconds are, so the GPS devices many of us use, right? Because many of us kind of depend on GPS devices. GPS devices with these satellites that are 12,000 miles above the Earth, every day there's a time correction because these nanosecond difference between those satellites, the satellites and the time on the satellites and the time that we live in and is all, it needs to be, in order for the measurements all work, it has to be exactly the same time. And so these, you know, nanoseconds, partial, you know, 0.10 nanoseconds or something of time difference has to be corrected for. Or 100 nanoseconds. It's come down to that. Yeah, I don't think in the time of the Buddha he thought much about nanoseconds. he had to worry about it. So it's kind of remarkable, but it's also remarkable that I think that just in my lifetime, how much time has become more and more of a pressing thing, an issue, and an event that we live by. And so it's easy to imagine that we become time poor. We don't have enough time, and we wish we had more time. And some of it is that there's so much available to us, and there's a kind of hunger for it and expectation we should be able to get to everything that's made available to us. I still remember fondly all kinds of times in my life when I was young of looking back at it now. There was no internet. There was no cell phones. What did I do? I'd go the whole day without checking for a message on my phone. Is that legal? Or possible? I remember, I have happy memories now. I didn't think about it then. But now, these many years later, I actually have a visceral memory of walking around San Francisco with lots of time. And the streets being, compared to the traffic now, being much more spacious. The things of, the whole feeling of the city has changed. And that was one of the great values of the monastery, that all the different monasteries and retreat centers I've been at, is how the relationship to time changes so radically. So that there's no time pressure, very little time pressure. Even though the cooks had to be had things on time, there was also lots of space, lots of time. And there wasn't so much to do. You weren't supposed to, you didn't have to check the internet and news. And my kids watch TV programs on their computer. And I'm just amazed how many there seems to be. I mean, it's like you can spend your life watching new TV programs and not get to them all. That would be a sad life, wouldn't it? If you didn't get to them all. So the point being that there's so much to do that can do and were available to us in a way that hasn't been available for people for until recent times. It's a phenomenal thing to live in this world. So it takes some care to learn and to navigate the world of time, to learn to navigate the world of all these possibilities that exist for us. And today's topic is time. How to be time rich. If you want to be rich in time. Spacious time. Live in spacious time, not tight time, contracted time. Live in a kind of boundless time, as opposed to a bounded time that's bounded by all the concerns and needs and duties and responsibilities. And so one of the things I learned in the monastery was to live in time, like this schedule of things that had to be done at a certain time, but do it within spacious time. And that, so the two don't have to be separate from each other. There's a way to be relaxed, calm, and fully engaged. And, I was working in the monastery sometimes. It was, very engaged, very active, engaged work. And there was a sense of spacious time for it. Sometimes time would kind of disappear because of the full engagement in what we're doing. So, meditation. Meditation is a wonderful reference point for discovering our relationship to time. And in many ways, meditation is a time to do something very different than what we usually do in our lives. And then in that difference, have the difference highlighted. So if we're always running around, being busy, and it's become second nature to do that, and then what's the problem? That's what everyone else is doing too. And then you sit down to meditate and you feel the cost of that running around. You feel the impact it has of a distracted mind, a tense body, And then in meditation, because of the contrast, then we can see the busyness in a way we couldn't do it when we were living in it. We see it in a different way. So meditation is a reference point to understand ourselves. And that's a different purpose than thinking meditation is about becoming calm. It's fine for it to be help you become calmer. But if that's it's all about, you're not going to become wise about how you operate when you're not calm. And if you use meditation, a little bit start seeing the contrast, the difference, to use it as a standard, kind of, to see, really get to know yourself better, what's going on. So, when we first sit and meditate, maybe not first, sooner or later, most people will notice that their mind is distracted. And they bring the mind back to the breath. Then they get distracted again. Come back to the breath. Distracted. So to be distracted, chances are you're living in time. You're caught up in time in some way. So to ask yourself the question, when you're distracted from the present moment, are you thinking about the past, kind of living in the past, thinking in the past? Are you thinking about the future? Are you somehow actively, distractingly thinking about the present? Maybe the present that's not here, but someplace else. Or are you thinking in kind of a mythic, fictional time? You know, fantasies can, you know, don't exist in time exactly. They can just be a fantasy. Or you might be solving some wonderful problem or task or something, writing the great American novel in your head. So that doesn't, you know, it's kind of like outside of time, but so it's kind of, I call it mythic time or fictional time. And which is your tendency? Which is your default? Where do you tend to go in time when you get distracted? When you get distracted, is it more often in the past? Is it more often in the future? Is it more often about things happening in the present but not here and now? Is it more often do you get distracted by what's actually happening here and now? And you can sit here and meditate with a room full of people and just have your eyes closed. And, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of masks that people are wearing right now. I can't remember because my eyes are closed. Let me see if I remember their color and their shape. I wonder if someone had the ideal mask. And I'll try to remember that person had that kind of shape. And that's distracted thinking, right? But it's about the present moment. So where does your mind go? What does it do? And if there's a pattern for you, what does that tell you? What does that say about you? If you're mostly thinking about the past, what are the values, what are the priorities, what are the desires, what are the concerns you have that keep bringing you back into the past? If it's mostly about the future, what are the concerns, what are the values, what's the energy? What is it about the future that keeps pulling you into the future? And so forth for the other ones. So to try to understand oneself deeper, what's going on here? For the purpose of meditation, knowing what it is that, not just knowing that you're thinking about that past, future, and so forth, but to know, you know, this is my pattern, and this is kind of what's driving the pattern. It helps you then to bring your mindfulness to something deeper than the distracted thought. If you're thinking about the past because you still feel hurt about what happened years ago, and you're trying to navigate and negotiate and figure out the hurt, and who did what, and who's to blame, who's responsible, what you could have done, and just reviewing it and reliving what happened a long time ago, maybe that hurt still festers. And that hurt might need our attention. The hurt is always in the present moment. And if we want to heal the hurt, it's probably not going to be healed by making a better past, thinking about, but rather to really meet the pain and learn how to sit with that in present moment. If we're thinking about the future, some people, they think about the future because they're planning and they're, you know, anxious about the future. The anxiety is what needs our attention. Or maybe it's delightful anticipation. I know people who just seem to have a joy in anticipating things. And one of my sons was that way. He would just like lay in bed and he'd be anticipating, planning, and it seemed like that was like, and sometimes he loved, like when he was a little kid, he loved like building a stage for a play. But the play would never happen. And that was besides the point. It was just the building, the anticipating, and that was so much fun. And then he'd build it, and then he'd go on to do something else. And so there's, you know, sometimes it's joy that brings us into past and future and being distracted. So that's nice. But if you bring your present moment attention into the joy and follow that back to the source, follow that back inside to what's going on, that's a very different movement to arrive in the present moment than continually kind of batting away distracted thoughts and letting go and coming back, letting go and coming back. Because you're getting to the underlying source from which these distracted thoughts are bubbling up from. Probably something that's close, more intimate and more important and closer to something valuable, you know, really important about yourself. So that's one way meditation can be a reference point and seeing, understanding what's going on with our distracted thinking. Another thing about distracted thinking is that there's probably desires involved in them that are time-sensitive, time concerns. Like, and so what is that? How does time operate in the concern itself? And so, for example, being anxious and planning in the future, it's because something is, again, time-bounded, and I have to get it done in a certain time. And so let me think about it ahead of time so I can do it fast enough or efficient enough. So time comes into play. But as we settle down more in meditation, then, and we're no longer so distracted, but here and present, time can still be an operating concern. It could be that, yeah, I'm present, but they better ring the bell. You know, when is this meditation going to be over? Yes, I've been present, but I've been present long enough. You know, and so, you know, so there's maybe restlessness coming up. And that's, you know, and something wanting something to come to an end. And or it could be that we're trying to get concentrated or calm or something. And so there's an attainment focus about attaining something in the future, hopefully in the next minute or something. But still, it's like leaning into the future and operating on the assumption that you have time, in the future time, and that you can kind of navigate and try to attain something in the future. And so time is operating again. So we're kind of being, I don't know if it's too strong a language you said, but we're being led around by time or we're caught up in time. What happens if we don't have a future in meditation? What happens if it's just about the present moment? So we would then no longer be attaining anything because attaining is always in the future. And so it's a little bit of a fantasy. And sometimes we do attain things, we do get calmer, so sometimes we can practice in such a way that good things happen to us. So it's not like it's illegal to do it and impossible to do it, but it is operating in time. And as the mind gets quieter, sooner or later, you'll notice that any concern about the future is a bit of a drag for the mind. Any concern for the future means the mind is activated with a certain activity of thinking and that's time involved. And what's fascinating about this is we start discovering how much that time belongs to a conceptual world that we create. At least the time that we experience, the time that we live in, is born in our minds, in how our minds operate. And it's not like a time is not like a the time that we live in, the time that we're operating under, is not cost free. It's not like, you know, the air that's just always here for us and we can just breathe and not have to think about it. There's sometimes the idea that time just exists. There's a big debate in philosophy. Does time exist? Does it not exist? How does it exist? What is time? Independent of those kinds of concerns, meditators can learn, as their mind gets quiet, that the very conceiving of things dependent on time takes mental energy, takes a kind of mental work. And if the mind is quiet enough, we'll see that work as being agitating. If you're super agitated to begin with, the level of agitation about the future is so subtle that it's inconsequential. It doesn't mean anything. Like, you can't give me a break. But when the mind is really quiet, we start seeing that the activity of even being concerned about a future takes work. It's agitating. It's ripples. It's on the surface of the mind's lake. Thinking about the past, same thing. So then if you want to settle more, we let go of past and future. And the way we do it in mindfulness practice, you can just let go of it, of course, but one way is, again, always turning towards what's going on. And feeling, where's that work? Where's that pressure? Yes, it feels like there's agitation or very subtle pressure or a little piece of stress having to do with this past and future. Where is it? Now, can I hold it? Can I bring my attention to it? So not let go of it as first chance you have, but keep coming back and feeling it and sensing it. And one of the advantages of doing that, it's kind of like starting to bring you, moving you back to the source, to use a kind of Buddhist language. And you're kind of following the stream back to the source. And you know, what is that source? Are you following it back? And then as the mind gets quieter, it's fascinating that concern for any kind of subtle concern as we're, like if you're following your breath, in-breath, any idea that there's an end to the out-breath is extra. Any idea that the beginning of the out-breath just happened is extra. What happens when you're just with experience of breathing without a past and a future? It can be very peaceful. It can be very settled. No past, no future, just this moment of the breathing, as if kind of like it's forever. But of course it isn't forever. It becomes something else, it becomes something else. But every new thing is just itself. Just that moment, just the experience. And some people will say that the moment of experience and time have become no different from each other. But just this time, just this. And so you can see that, for example, start seeing it and eating a meal. If you're eating quietly, not talking or on your device, but just eating, lifting a fork up to your mouth. You know, it's kind of goal-oriented, right? You're trying to get it up into the mouth in a timely way. But what if there's no, you know, you're living just without in a past and a future? There's like an infinite time for bringing that fork up to your mouth. It's qualitatively a different way of experiencing eating. Then if part of the mind is so, you know, a very subtle part of the mind is concerned about the results of the action, of getting it up there to the mouth so that, you know, you can, you know, put it in the mouth and put another mouthful of food on the fork quickly. Just to, and starts being sensitive, oh, walking down the steps. Each stepping is not without the past and the future. That becomes available, that sense of that, you can never do it. I don't know if you can ever do it 100% perfectly, but that's not the point, is to do it perfectly. The point is to see, use that as a reference point. You get a sense, oh, just close to the present, just this. And then we see, oh, there's still a little bit of greed or desire operating for something to be different in the next moment. Or a little bit of pressure to get to the bottom of the steps, as opposed to just walking down the steps, just walking. When eating, just eating. But I have so many things to do. I can't just walk down the steps. You know, I have all this stuff that has to be done and have to get there quickly. And if I don't, the sky will fall down. And just walking. Just this. But I have to be ready and just walking. And it's possible you'll discover that if you're walking someplace and you just walk without future in the past, just this activity is a thing of the moment. When you come to the next activity, you're actually in a better space to meet it, take care of it, be present for it, than if you were hurried and came out of breath and you have all these things to do and okay, now I'm here, now I have to do this quickly and so I can move on to the next thing. There's been times when I've started one thing and as soon as I start that thing, which I've been thinking about for a while to get to, I'm already thinking about the next thing I have to do or the next two things or three things I have to do. And this momentum, this of the mind, this habit formation of the mind to live in time, to live concerned about doing and getting to the next, what's in the future, what's in the future, is rather unfortunate how strong it can operate in some people's minds. So as we meditate, we get to see all this. And that's hopefully one of the opportunities in meditation is to really see your mind clearly. And how it's living in time, its relationship to time, and how much you can put down time and quiet the conceptualization, the conceiving of time that we do. And one of the fascinating feelings you can get from all this is the feeling that time always begins in the present. That's where time begins. The past begins in the present because we conceive of the past. In a few minutes, we'll leave here, and this talk will only exist for you in how you conceive of it, how you remember it, how your mind reconstructs it, being here, what it's like. So when you leave out the door, go out the door, the talk only exists in some kind of way in your memory. That when this talk becomes the past, that past was born here. The past is born in the present. That's a very different idea that of a linear movement from the future. Into the future, like it's a line. The past is behind us and the future is ahead of us. Some cultures have the future coming towards us. But what happens if we understand that time future, time past begins in the present? If that's the case, the present is the source for all time, past and future, in a certain kind of way. And if that's the case, how are we going to be responsible? How are we going to be intimate? How are we going to care for ourselves at that important juncture, this present moment where time begins? Are we creating time as a gift? Are we creating time as something that's useful and healthy for us and for others? We are the creators of time, at least for our own minds. We are the creators of the past, the creators of the future in a certain kind of way. So it gives us a phenomenal vantage point, phenomenal potential to live in the world a very different way around time. And so if you feel harried by time, if you feel in a hurry in the world of time, you've constructed that time. That's been born in your mind. Is that what you want to have produced in your mind for the world? Is that your gift to the world? A hurried mind, a harried mind? What happens if you construct a different time? Is there a timeless time? Is there spacious time? Is there a way of holding the events of your life, past, future, and present, in a wide open time? And that, I think, is one of the gifts of meditation, is that because to the degree to which we can get calm in meditation, it slows down the incessant kind of rush of thoughts, ideas, constructions, conceivings that the mind does. And one of those conceivings is the conceivings of around time. And so you get a sense, you get a feeling that time is now opened up, is more spacious. And that is a valuable place to take care. It's a valuable place to value, to see it as important, to see it as a teacher, see it as reflecting on what is important and your role in staying close to it and your role in losing it. And if you find yourself in a hurry, you've become attached to something. There's no hurrying without attachment. But there can be doing things fast without hurrying. There can be doing things fast without attachment. But you can't hurry without there being attachment. So as we slow down in this becoming the more spacious time, we have then the opportunity to discover what these attachments are. And why do we live with these attachments? Why do we give them so much authority? Why do we think that they're required and so necessary and so important? Follow that back. That idea back to the source. Where does that come from? Where does that arise from in you? What are the beliefs? What are the deeper feelings and emotions that give rise to the attachment that causes hurry? So, there is time poverty, which I think has been growing for our modern society. More and more people impoverished in time. And then there's being rich in time, the abundance of time. That is only a moment away. Or, you know, we have to be faster these days. It's only a nanosecond away. Abundance of time that's always here. So, I hope that this gives you something a little different than usual to be curious about and consider and talk to your friends about and study your mind with. May time become your friend by you becoming friend's time. Thank you.